Brath. It is coming up on 10 past 8. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for the Morning Show comes from Carthage College, where students can conduct NASA research, produce an original play, or join an in-house marketing agency as early as their freshman year. More information is available at carthage.edu. And we welcome you to the Thursday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We're beginning today's program with Claude Clegg, the Lyle V. Jones Distinguished Professor of African, African-American, and Diaspora Studies at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, the author of four previous books. His latest is titled The Black President, Hope and Fury in the Age of Obama, published by Johns Hopkins University Press. Professor Clegg, one of the first questions I wanted to be sure to ask you is, what does it feel like as a historian who I assume is more accustomed to looking back over a much longer expanse of time? I mean, to events that are much more distant in the past, to be looking at and trying to come to terms with something as recent as the Obama presidency. How different an undertaking did this feel like for you as a historian? And in a sense, did you feel like an historian at all as you wrote about the Obama presidency?
That's a great question. Yes, as a traditionally trained historian, we're mostly trained to look in the rearview mirror at things that have already happened and the dust has settled a bit on them, and we have some historical hindsight. So writing about the Obama presidency as it was unfolding before my eyes and the eyes of everyone else who was witnessing it was an interesting challenge, because I was in the situation in which I had to come up with a way to think about his time in office and what I was seeing eventually in a historical way through a historical lens without the benefit of a historical hindsight on the happenings, and having to build my own archive of materials that I collected over the course of his time in office. So that was an interesting challenge. Political scientists and anthropologists and others do this all the time. That is, they write about things that they're witnessing. But for we historians, it tends to be the case that we write about people who lived in a different time or who were dead, or about events that happened long before we even thought to put pen to paper or even thought about writing about that subject matter. So that was an interesting challenge. I eventually became more comfortable with it over time. But of course, the thing is that, as you're witnessing something, you don't know whether or not you're witnessing it and thinking about it and eventually writing about it in ways that, in 50 or 100 years, people will be thinking about it, in the same kind of way that you are. So, you're taking a risk in trying to think about recent history and historicizing it. And, of course, in 20 or 30 or 50 or 100 years from now, people will be still writing about the Obama presidency. But I'm hoping that they'll say, well, Clegg, he got it mostly right here. He did bring to bear his historical lens and get the story right for the most part. So that's the hope. But you're exactly right. It's a strange way to write history. You become a bit of a source. So I'm a source on the Obama presidency because I was a witness to it in ways that historians who write about the past usually aren't that close or close enough to be considered sources themselves.
Right. They weren't living at the time of James K. Polk or whoever
right.
It is that they're writing about.
That's right.
But you were very much not only alive during President Obama's presidency, but watched it with tremendous eagerness, as you did many of the events that unfolded ahead of that. You have said that one of the most important things that you can accomplish is to challenge simplistic narratives about the Obama presidency. What would be one or two of the most significant simplistic narratives that you hope you can call into question with the writing of your book?
Oh, yeah, there are several. If you had to boil it down to one or two, one would be the his predecessor or his successor, and how his successor has characterized the Obama years as a failure. The Obama, the economic recovery under Obama as being more or less the Trump recovery and having everything to do with him, and that nothing good happened during the Obama administration in regard to the economy, in regard to health care, in regard to immigration and so forth. It's all, you know, all the whatever good things and how they character how they are characterized as good things happened only when Donald Trump came to office. So that would be, I think, the biggest sort of stew of misinformation that the book is aiming to address. That is, the book is aiming to determine the fact pattern of the Obama administration on the economy, on immigration, on clean energy, on foreign affairs, on race relations, and so forth, in the wake of a Trump presidency that is more or less positioned as the anti-Obama presidency, which Trump is trying to overturn. The Affordable Care Act, build a wall between Mexico, trying to, of course, pack the Supreme Court with as many justices as he can of his ilk and so forth. So that would be, I think, the biggest, that was the biggest challenge that the book took on, that is to get the facts out about the Obama presidency even as his successors sort of flooding the zone with misinformation about various things. And I think the book accomplishes that, and I think other books that have been written, serious books that have been written about the Obama presidency, that will be the other, that will be the thing that they'll have to be conscious of. That is, they'll be seeing his presidency within the context of both the Bush presidency and the Trump presidency and now the Biden presidency, and trying to, going to the sources and the credible sources and writing about his time in office and his context, you know, even though, again, we had four dedicated years of the Trump administration seeking to overturn and mischaracterize President Obama's time in office.
And I want to hasten to add that your book is, to quite an extent, nonpartisan. That is, this is not a book about, first and foremost, what a wonderful president Barack Obama was, that you are open about ways in which he did not succeed, ways in which he maybe was responsible for certain missteps. And I appreciate the fact that you are trying to come at this in a way that is thorough and fair and balanced.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah, that was my my whole intent as a historian is, even though I witnessed the presidency of Barack Obama and that of his two predecessors so far, it would have done no favors for the reader for me just to, you know, be congratulatory about a presidency which is, all presidencies are complicated. No president gets exactly what they want. No president is perfect. Obama simply has his sort of shortcomings, as any other president does, whether it's, you know, really coming late to the table on any kind of criminal justice reform and his hand being pushed by the social justice protests of his day and the Black Lives Matter movement and so forth. Very little was done on immigration. His critics call him the deporter-in-chief. He deported hundreds of thousands of people to the consternation of many of his allies. I think he did so to show Republicans that he could be tough on immigration and so forth, and hopefully the Republicans will sit down and say, well, this is the guy we can deal with and, you know, make a cut a deal with on immigration. And, of course, it's a misreading of the Republican Party, which is going even further to the right in regard to immigration and nativism, and of course, nothing gets done on immigration. So there's certainly a number of shortcomings and things that Obama wasn't able to get done. Largely, a lot of that has to do with the fact that he had an unwilling Congress in the hands of Republicans, but also I think issues of timing and issues of order. That is, he tried to accomplish some things earlier than he tried to accomplish other things, then perhaps there are certain things that should have been pursued earlier when his party had majorities in both of the houses. But again, hindsight is 20/20. The big thing is that, yeah, that was my entire purpose of writing the book, to try to give the fact pattern without the noise of my own, you know, political views and so forth, and to ground the book in serious sources so that the reader can come to their own conclusions.
Right. Your book is titled The Black President, and I think that's an interesting choice given the fact that one of the things you remind us is that Barack Obama was, in a number of different ways, something of an anomaly. That is, his experience as a black American was far from typical, if there can be something like a typical experience for a black American. What do you think are the most important ways in which he was an anomaly? I mean, what were the most significant ways in terms of the kind of president he ultimately was, and the fact that he was able to ascend to the presidency at all?
Mm-hmm. I think the whole promise of Obama is that he's going to help the nation think past race. Now, that's not to say that he was, you know, was under the illusion that he could be a post-racial president, or after his election we were in this post-racial nirvana in which race didn't matter. He was very explicit in saying that that was not the case. But I do think that the whole optimistic promise of hope and change and yes, we can, was that he was going to get us to think in terms of we all being Americans first, and there not being blue states and red states and so forth, that at the end of the day, we were Americans, and that he would help to take us to not a post-racial place, but a post-partisan place. And again, the thinking was, in the midst of this economic catastrophe that became known as the Great Recession, you have hundreds of thousands of jobs being lost per month, and you're having the implosion of the housing and credit market. People by the hundreds of thousands, millions are losing their homes and so forth. In the midst of this crisis, he believed that the two parties would come together. They put aside their petty differences and their ideological cleavages and so forth, and they lift together to lift the country out of this spot. He believed that that would be the case. He was, of course, wrong about that. But this idea of the post-partisan America, or Americans lifting together as a single community in this moment, this hour of crisis, was something he really believed in. And again, the optimism behind that. I think that being the first black president, I think that he expands what blackness is in the United States, and that as an experience and that as an identity. But at the same time, doesn't expand it in a way that sort of throws the door open and says, okay, from here on out, anyone who's black can be president. That's not the case. He has a certain pedigree. He went to Columbia undergraduate. He went to Harvard Law. He was a state senator from Illinois, and then he was a U.S. senator from Illinois. So there's a certain sort of pedigree still that a person has to have to become president of the United States. And he just happened to be from that pedigree, but he also just happened to be black as well. But I think the pedigree was vitally important, the Harvard, the Ivy League, and being a congressman and or a senator and so forth. And I think that was as vital as him being African-American. I think being African-American and then being able to win that election opens the doors for people like Kamala Harris, but who was also a U.S. senator before and then Attorney General of California. But at the same time, it's a very elite strata of African-Americans who have that kind of access. So it's the gate. There are still gatekeepers and gatekeeping mechanisms to keep just anyone from becoming president, especially anyone of color. from becoming president. But I do think he becoming president opens the door to a wider array of people seeking that office, and opens our understanding of the sort of diversity of black experience out there. Of course, he being the black president gives us Donald Trump as well. That is, I don't think you can understand the possibility of this guy, this reality TV show host, you know, string of failed businesses and bankruptcies behind him, thrice married and so forth, becoming competitive as a presidential candidate without understanding the backlash against this idea of a black man in the White House. And the possibility that even the likes of a Donald Trump could be the vessel for the backlash against Barack Obama. I think that it's impossible to understand the possibility of a Trump without understanding the reality of a black president and, again, the reaction to that.
Is the reality of Donald Trump succeeding Barack Obama, is that at the heart of your line when you say that the Obama presidency was the best and the worst of times for black Americans, or is that about something else?
That was more or less about the experience of African Americans during the Obama presidency, and that was Obama's own take. That is, it was the best of times, the worst of times. I think he's probably right. I think the symbolism of a black president, a black first family, is extraordinarily important. We have a whole generation of young people who grew up in their first consciousness of who was in the White House. You know, it was 8 years of a black first family. And I don't think we have fully processed the meaning of that for young folks who've grown up in the 21st century. And that was normal to have a black first family in the White House. And I think there are other ways in which substantial ways in which the Obama presidency was beneficial to African Americans, whether it's the Affordable Care Act, which disproportionately helped African Americans, working class Americans, Hispanics, and so forth, get health insurance with the expansion of Medicaid going along with that as well. And some other metrics, too, were as we saw the country crawl out of the Great Recession. Pell Grants, expansion of Pell Grants, food assistance, and some other ways in which people benefited. But it was the worst time, the worst of times for African Americans as well. If you looked at every statistic, every metric, they were at the bottom when it comes to unemployment statistics, loss of household wealth during the Great Recession, loss of houses, mass incarceration rates, lack of health care access, even though the Affordable Care Act addressed some of that, still they were at the bottom of those statistics. So even though you have a black first family and a black head of state, those statistics really, especially the disparities, the racial disparities in those statistics don't really close. The gaps don't really close, even as the country in general is coming out of that Great Recession. African Americans are doing so at a much slower and much more uneven rate. And there were black critics who thought Obama should have done more, that he should have had these targeted remedies for the most vulnerable, the people at the bottom of those statistics. And that was a tension for his whole presidency. Those on the one hand who are saying, you know, you need to really address the urban crisis when it comes to unemployment, when it comes to housing and so forth, especially among African Americans, your most loyal constituency, the people who gave you 90+% of their vote. And Obama, on the other hand, saying that I'm the president of the entire United States and I can't just pick and choose losers, especially if I'm picking winners among my own group, among African Americans. That's not a good look when it comes to reelection politics. And my policies have to be broad brush policies, like the Affordable Care Act, in which I'm trying to help everyone get health insurance. Although, if you look under the hood of the Affordable Care Act, African Americans and the working class people and others perhaps benefit disproportionately from that act, and Pell Grant expansion and so forth. So Obama would say, as president of the United States, you know, I have to be looking out for everyone. But many of my policies, whether it's Pell Grants, whether it's the Affordable Care Act, and other things, help the most vulnerable, and that would include African Americans. But you know, you have to package these things as race-neutral policies, lest, you know, the reelection math, which is going to be dependent upon white voters, coming out and voting for Obama in 2012, that election math won't work if he comes across as having a quote-unquote black agenda.
Mm. Your book explores that and so many other fascinating challenges. The book, again, is The Black President, Hope and Fury in the Age of Obama, published by Johns Hopkins University Press, and the author, Claude Clegg. Professor Clegg, thank you so much for giving the world this fascinating book, and thank you for being my guest on The Morning Show today.
Excellent. Thank you for having me.
You are listening to The Morning Show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg, and now an interview that comes from The Morning Show archive. For the next few minutes here on WGTD, I am excited to speak with Kevin Boyle, who is an associate professor of history at Ohio State University and the author of several different books, most recently a fascinating, inspiring, and troubling story, which he calls Arc of Justice, a saga of race, civil rights, and murder in the jazz age. And the story here is one which I knew absolutely nothing about, but it turns out to be a very important moment in the history of race relations in the United States, and was one of those moments which probably contributed in various ways to some of the advancements which eventually did occur later in the 20th century. It surrounds the case of an African-American trying to make his way in the world and instead finding great resistance from certain whites. And that clash of culture is told very, very vividly and movingly in this book called Arc of Justice, which is published by Henry Holt and Company. And Kevin Boyle, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thank you so much for having me.
I love the title of the book, and am not familiar with this quote from which it is taken. Explain the title, Arc of Justice.
Sure. The quote comes from a 19th century abolitionist, but it became famous because Martin Luther King made it a common part of his speeches, and the phrase, the saying goes that the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice.
The idea being, I guess, that that there is often reversal after reversal after reversal, all kinds of frustrations.
That's right.
But this idea that at the end things will eventually begin to resolve.
Exactly.
towards right, towards justice.
Yeah, that the struggle for equal rights in the United States has been a long and difficult one, but there is that kind of hope of a final triumph.
Tell me what familiarity you had with this particular story about this man from the South named Ossian Sweet.
It's a story that takes place in 1925, and it takes place in Detroit. That's the center of the story. And Detroit is my hometown. So it's a story that folks in Detroit at least had heard of. It was part of local history. And really the tricky part for me was realizing that no one outside of Detroit had ever heard this story. So it was a story that you read in the newspaper once in a while. You see somebody write, remember the Sweet case. And so it was just kind of part of memory.
So you had at least a vague sense that that this had occurred and probably knew something about it, but your task was to tell it in a compelling way so the rest of us would pay attention to it.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And for me, it was also a great learning process because, like you said, I had a vague sense of it the way people do when you see something in passing, but I had no idea of the richness of the story until I started to do the work on the book.
One of the choices you make as an author is to try to set the stage for this specific story by giving us some sense of what American cities were like back in the 1920s, cities like Detroit. Apparently you believe that that is essential to us really understanding the dynamics that were at play here.
Exactly, because what Dr. Sweet's story is part of really fundamental transformations that sweep across not just Detroit, but almost every big city in the United States in the 1910s and in the 1920s. And the two critical parts of that story, one is that there was a massive, massive migration of African Americans out of the rural South and to the big cities, particularly starting in World War I. And as that migration occurred and as black populations in cities across the North soared, then suddenly the cities became sites of segregation in ways that they hadn't been prior to the Great Migration. Black populations were tiny, and now all of a sudden they weren't. And whites, as the population soared, began to insist on a level of segregation, not only in Detroit, but in New York, in Chicago, in Milwaukee, in Cleveland, that really hadn't been there before. And that's a huge change, and that's the background for what happens to Dr. Sweet.
Yeah, you mentioned the fact that earlier than that, there was absolutely no, or basically no formal segregation in any of these cities. And then all of a sudden there is this population, and then it's as though, at least in many cases, these city leaders would sort of scramble around to assemble something which would keep things, I suppose, in their mind in some sort of orderly state.
Yeah, and really the pivot in the North, unlike the South, I mean, the South, the pivot of segregation is so much kind of public places, drinking fountains, restaurants, theaters, buses. But in the North, the pivot becomes the neighborhood. That prior to the Great Migration, there were black neighborhoods, but there were black neighborhoods in the same way that there were Polish neighborhoods or Italian neighborhoods, which meant that maybe half the population of a given neighborhood would be black or Polish or Italian, and the rest wouldn't be. Then all of a sudden, as the Great Migration increases, whites decide that they don't want to live next to blacks anymore. And if an African-American had been well-to-do, like Dr. Sweet was, generally they lived, oftentimes, they lived in completely white, otherwise completely white neighborhoods. Now all of a sudden, white people decide, well, they don't want this anymore. They want the neighborhoods to be all white. And then, which means, of course, some neighborhood has to be all black. And that becomes the center of segregation in the North, which is very different than the segregation of the South. But it's still segregation.
Right. It's interesting, too, when you help explain how this was accomplished, you say that no one coordinated the businessmen's practices and the homeowners' actions. They spread by quiet agreement, sealed by a handshake in the boardroom, a directive from the home office, a conversation over coffee in the neighbor's kitchen.
Yeah.
I mean, that makes makes this in some ways even more insidious, because it would be, in many cases, sort of an unspoken code.
Yeah, that's a great point, really, because in the South, as terrible as segregation was, and it was awful, it was absolutely awful, it was a public process. It was a political process led by political leaders. And so they were very upfront about what they were doing. But the Northern system of segregation, it happens in such a kind of quiet way. It happens in these informal means. There's never a political debate over whether we should segregate neighborhoods. It doesn't become a fact of law. It becomes a practice of business communities. And by doing that, it becomes then absolute.
You tell us about Detroit in the 1920s. And this is, of course, in some respects, the heyday of your hometown.
Boy, isn't it. Yeah.
Tell us more about, to help us understand this moment in Detroit history.
Well, if you've been to Detroit lately, any time in the last 20 years, really, it's a city that's really struggled tremendously with economic problems. Detroit 1920s was the great boom town in America. It was the home of the cutting-edge industry. It was the Silicon Valley of the 1920s. Because it had the automobile industry, which was the great growth industry of that age. And so the population was absolutely skyrocketing. And it was drawing, the city was drawing people from around the world.
If I may interrupt, I love when you say Ford's Triumph triggered the industrial version of a gold rush.
Yeah, that's exactly it. That it's a classic kind of Western boom town on a massive scale. This had been a kind of mid-sized town at the turn of the century, and now all of a sudden it rockets up to become the fourth largest city in the country. And it's just bursting at the seams with people, and property values are skyrocketing, and people are scrambling for space, and it's in that context that the racial dynamic takes place.
Tell us about this man from the South, this doctor by the name of Ocean Sweet. First of all, am I pronouncing his name correctly?
They pronounce it Ocean.
Ocean.
But I struggled with that for a long time.
Right.
Hear that one.
Well, there's a little town in Iowa close to where I grew up that's called Ocean. It's spelled the same way.
Oh, how interesting.
But here it is, Ossian. Ocean Sweet was, as you've already touched on, just one of many African Americans who moved from the South to the North. But, of course, he moved there under different circumstances than did many others.
Yeah, he's a classic American success story. There's no other way to really understand him. He was a man born into a very ordinary family, lived in the Deep South in Central Florida. His parents were small-time farmers. They owned a tiny little plot of land, and they rented out a few extra fields to make ends meet. But what they infused in their children, and Ocean was their oldest son who had lived to adulthood, was this driving desire to succeed, that if they worked hard, if they lived good lives, they could climb the social ladder. They couldn't do that in the South at the turn of the century. The system was designed not to give him that opportunity. So when he was 13 years old, they sent him away. They sent him to Wilberforce University, traditionally black college that's down near Dayton, Ohio. And in those days, they had a high school. So he got a high school education at Wilberforce. He stayed and got his college degree from Wilberforce in 1917. And that alone put him way above, virtually, in terms of education, virtually anyone in America, black or white. People didn't go to college for the most part. Couldn't stop there. He went on to Howard University, the great black college in Washington, D.C., and got his medical degree in 1921. So he had become this professional man, someone rising from ordinary status to the highest of professions in America. Could have gone back home, back to Bartow, but he was ambitious. And so he went to Detroit because he knew that in Detroit he could make the sort of money and build the sort of practice that he had trained himself to do, had transformed himself to do. That's what brought him to Detroit in 1921 and into this city that was undergoing these dramatic changes.
Hmm. One interesting choice you make as an author is to give us the context, and then you sort of, in effect, jump to the sort of frightening climax, or the first climax of this story, a very dramatic, terrifying night for Dr. Sweet and his family. Before we even tell that story, I'm just curious to know why you, as the author, had the story unfold as you do in the book.
Well, it was really important to me to say, to trace back, for my own sake, and I hope for the reader's sake too, to see how Dr. Sweet's story that night is part of a long history, not simply of black America, but for his own family, to see how his trajectory rises out of these extraordinary circumstances. He's the grandson of slaves, and here he is moving up the American social ladder and doing it, you know, in a very calculated way. And I wanted readers to see that what happens that one night in September of 1925 doesn't come out of nowhere. It comes out of a long, complicated, and really tragic history.
Very good. The frightening night we're talking about is a night when he and other friends and family are accused of a murder,
yes,
which has occurred in this neighborhood. But we need to get Dr. Sweet placed into this neighborhood and talk a bit about the courage, and I suppose many saw as his audaciousness.
That's right.
In wanting to live where he chose to live in Detroit.
Yeah, it's a wonderful way to put it. What happens is really very simple. Dr. Sweet gets married. He marries a young woman. They have a child, and they go off to buy a house. And it's nothing more than that at the start. But the house they find, it's a very ordinary neighborhood, but it's a completely white neighborhood. This is in the summer of 1925. And what he realizes, Dr. Sweet knows, is that his crossing the color line in the summer of 1925 is a huge risk. And so when moving day comes, on September 8th of 1925, he and his wife, Gladys, ask two of his brothers, who happen to be in town, to come the night they move in to help protect the house. They bring friends in to help protect the house in case a white mob should come to drive them out. So there are 11 people in the house all together. And sure enough, the first night they're there, a huge mob gathers outside. It's a corner house. It's on the corner of a block. So they're surrounded on two sides by 100, 200 people. neighbors who are determined they want these black people out of their neighborhood. Nothing happens the first night. There's no violence. Second night, September 9th, the Sweets and their brothers and his brothers and their friends gather again, and this time around 8:30, just as it's getting dark, just one tiny little thing happens, and the mob starts throwing stones. Well, the Sweets are inside. They're up in the upstairs windows, and their friends are in the upstairs windows, and they have guns. They've secreted into the house 10 guns, pistols, rifles. And when the mob starts to attack, they open fire on the mob. And they hit two white people. One they injure, a young man across the street. One they kill, a man who lives down the block and is standing on the lawn across the street. They hit him in the back, and they kill him instantly. And at that moment, the police, who are out on the street for crowd control, rush inside the house, and they arrest all 11 people, Dr. and Mrs. Sweet, his two brothers, and all their friends, and charge them all with first-degree murder. That's the night of terror that transforms their story and their lives.
Mm. You tell that story thrillingly well, and I'm not sure I've ever read anything like it before, in which we had such a palpable sense of what it was like to be inside that home with an angry, vicious mob outside. I mean, it is just incredibly chilling to think of a law-abiding family being subjected to that. And of course, the Sweets were not unique in facing that kind of hatred.
No, not at all. In fact, that very summer, there had been four different black families driven out of their homes by white mobs, which is one of the reasons Dr. Sweet brought all those guns with him, because he knew what not only what a mob could do, having grown up in the South, but that this was a likely event. And, of course, he was exactly right.
What kind of accounts exist about exactly what happened that night? And how are you able to piece that all together?
It's a great question. There's a series of steps that I went through. There are the public accounts, the newspapers, for instance, that give us repeated stories. There is the accounts that come out in the trial of what happened, and there are subsequent trials. There are oral histories taken of some of the people who were in the house, including Dr. Sweet's brother, who are done, and those are done, but I think, in 1959, 1960. And then I had this wonderful stroke of luck that I found the transcript of the interrogation of all 11 African Americans who were arrested that night. All 11 people had been in the house. They're taken to police headquarters, and they're interrogated that very night. And I found the transcript of that interrogation. So what you hear is all 11 people describing one by one to the police that night the terror they felt standing inside the house. And then one other last piece, which was really important to me, is I've spent time in that house. There's a family, a wonderful family, that still lives there, and they invited me in to see the house. And when you stand in that upstairs window of the bedroom and you look out on that street and you see how tiny that lawn is and how close that street is, then you can feel a sense of the terror they must have had that night.
By the way, you mentioned that it had first begun that second night as normal a night as can be if there's a mob gathered outside one's house.
Yeah.
But then, I forget what you said, something very simple occurred, and they began throwing stones or something like that. Can you explain what you were talking about?
Sure. What happens is that Dr. Sweet's, as I mentioned, there were 11 people in the house. Well, but 8 o'clock that night, there were 9 people in the house. Dr. Sweet's little brother, Otis, was supposed to be there, too, and he was supposed to bring a friend to help him. Otis had a tendency to be late to things, and he didn't show up on time. He wasn't in the house when he was supposed to be. And then around 8:30 that night, Otis arrived with his friend. And they came in a taxi, of all things. The taxi rumbles up down the street through this mob that's out on the sidewalks surrounding the house. They stop right in front of the house. He leaps out of the taxi, and so does his friend, and they run up into the up to the front door of the house to get inside. And it's the sight of two more African Americans going into that house that seems to tip the mob, that when they see Otis and the friend running up, and it couldn't have taken him more than a few seconds because, as I said, it's a small front yard. That's when the rocks start to flow. So it's the simplest little trigger. He was late. Hmm. Had he not been late, would something else have happened? I don't know. Wow. But that's what gets the rocks flying.
Hmm. What is the story from that point on is, in effect, a legal thriller, or a judicial thriller, if there is such a thing. But the trial which ensues. And this is a trial which, as you recount, attracts an enormous amount of attention. And one of America's most famous lawyers is drawn into the fray.
Yeah, what happens is that after the Sweets are arrested, word of their arrest gets to the NAACP, the great leading civil rights organization. And the director of the NAACP immediately announces, for various reasons, that the NAACP will defend the Sweets, all 11 of the defendants. They will mount the defense. And what they manage to do, it takes them about a month, but what they manage to do is to hire the most famous criminal attorney in the United States, possibly, well, I'd argue, in the 20th century. They hire as the Sweets' criminal attorney the great Clarence Darrow. And 1925 is a big year for Clarence Darrow because it had been that summer of 1925 that he had fought the famous Scopes trial down in Dayton, Tennessee, the great argument over teaching of evolution. And so he was at the height of his fame, and he comes to Detroit in the autumn of 1925 to defend the Sweets. The Sweet case is his next case after the Scopes trial.
Hmm. How are you able to capture for us what occurs in this particular trial? I mean, that seems like an obvious question, but I think most of us don't really understand the way in which a trial can be, in a sense, relived down to such tiny details.
Yeah, it's not at all a simple question. It's actually one of the great challenges of being an historian, because you're obviously wedded to the documentation you have. But the great luck of that is that the trial has a transcript. The NAACP paid to have the court recorder or have someone transcribe the entire trial. And so there is this thousands and thousands page document that I could use to recreate the trial, adding in material from the NAACP, which had representatives at the trial every day, from the newspapers. And through that combination, to piece together the action of that entire courtroom experience. And the keys, of course, to the story are both having witnesses on the stand, and they come from the neighborhood, and Dr. Sweet takes the stand himself, but also Darrow's great ability with words. That's his great gift. He's not a great lawyer, and he would admit that. He doesn't even care to learn the law particularly well, but what he did understand was how to move a juror with this kind of ocean of words.
Hmm. You mentioned in particular something which I think is interesting, that one of the things that Clarence Darrow was able to do brilliantly well was to take the witnesses for the prosecution, people from the neighborhood, I presume, and others. And you say Darrow transformed those who took the stand from the decent men and women the prosecution claimed them to be into idiots, city cousins of the slope-browed simpletons he and his fellow sophisticates had humiliated in the backwoods of Tennessee the summer before.
Yeah. So what he does, this is a very ordinary neighborhood. This is a neighborhood of kind of the upper reaches of the working class and the lower reaches of the middle class. Dr. Sweet actually bought his home in a neighborhood where he had a much higher status than the white people. And that wasn't uncommon because he had to pay more for the house. And what Darrow does is he trades on that. He takes those people, and I don't think they were evil people, and he transforms them into fools. He makes fun of them. He humiliates them. And he uses every trick he can to do that. And, of course, they're terrified. Here they are sitting in a courtroom. Most of them probably have never been in a courtroom before, and they have this famous person in front of them, and it's easy to do. And then what he manages to do at the same time is he shows the jurors, who are all white, Dr. Sweet as this incredibly successful man, an articulate man, an educated man, and he plays on the contrast. He says to the jurors, who do you want to identify with? Those people, those idiots who live on Garland Avenue and for some bizarre reason think they're better than Dr. Sweet. Well, look at the two of them. the two groups, and you decide who's better and who you want to identify with. That's part of the defensive strategy, and it's brilliant.
Hmm. We should mention that at several points in the book, you tell us very honestly that the central protagonist, Dr. Ocean Sweet, was not a particularly likable person. And that's clearly something you think that it's worth us knowing, and that's something that is worth your acknowledging as the author here.
Well, I think it's a combination of things. Partly, it's the truth. It would be wonderful if you had your chief protagonist being the embodiment of all virtue, but he wasn't. He was a difficult man in a lot of ways. He was a man who had achieved great things and knew it and didn't mind letting you know it, and that can be an annoying thing, and it comes across in the letters that you see from him in some of his actions. He could be an arrogant man. The other point, though, I guess, from that is that we have a tendency, I think, when we write history, to want to see everybody is either good, all good, and all bad. And people aren't. They're human. And history is a human story. We need to see people who do great things for the wrong reasons sometimes. And we need to realize that people have complex characters in the same way that all of us do. Hmm. That doesn't change simply because they're figures in the past.
We should mention the fact that the story is also complex in terms of what unfolds once a verdict is finally reached. Can we say what the verdict is, or would you rather leave that as a secret for our listeners?
Of course, it'd be wonderful to leave it as a secret, but sure, I'll be happy to.
And it's up to you.
No. Let me put it this way. There are two trials. First trial ends in a hung jury. That's of all 11 of the defendants. Second trial is just of one. It's of Ocean Sweet's little brother, Henry. Henry, on the night of the murder, admits he fired into the crowd. None of the other defendants will tell the police that. But he says, well, yeah, they were going to kill us. I shot at them. And so they put him on trial, assuming that if they can't convict him, they can't convict anybody. And they don't. They can't convict him because Darrow managed to get him acquitted. It's an extraordinary thing. 12 white men on that jury box agree that Henry Sweet had the right to defend that home from a white mob, even if it meant killing a member of that mob.
Hmm. One would hope that that life would proceed easily and happily for the Sweet family after that. And unfortunately, various kinds of unhappiness do intrude. But of course, remaining central to the story and its significance is the fact, as you say, that such a verdict could be reached at that time and place under such circumstances. Help us understand what the ramifications of this were beyond those who were directly involved.
Well, that's in some ways the tragic of the part of the story, because what happens is that this is an incredible triumph for the NAACP, for Darrow, and of course for the Sweets. They're saved from life in prison, which is what they would have been facing. On the other hand, the very issue that they confronted, the very issue that was at the heart of this and where we started talking today, is the segregation of cities, the division of cities into black and white, separate and unequal. And that issue did not get resolved in the African Americans' favor, that the segregation of cities marched onward. It became solidified. This case didn't stop it. And in fact, the Southern system of segregation in the United States obviously is dead and gone. No one drinks from separate drinking fountains today. Nobody rides in the back of the bus because law tells them they have to. But the segregation of cities remains largely in place. And of all of America's cities, the most segregated city in America today is Detroit. And there's the tragedy of the story, that the issue, in fact, was lost while the case was won.
The book, again, is called Arc of Justice, A Saga of Race, Civil Rights, and Murder in the Jazz Age. It's published by Henry Holt and Company, and its author, Kevin Boyle. Kevin Boyle, I congratulate you on a really superb book, and I'm glad we got to talk about it today on The Morning Show. I thank you so much.
Thank you. I really appreciate you giving me the opportunity.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, an interview with British music journalist Paul Sexton, whose first book, which has just been published, is called Prince, Portrait of an Artist in Memories and Memorabilia, in which Paul Sexton speaks with a number of talented musicians and artists who collaborated with Prince over the course of his all-too-short life and career. That's tomorrow on The Morning Show. Support for The Morning Show comes from Carthage College, where students can conduct NASA research, produce an original play, or join an in-house marketing agency as early as their freshman year. Information